And well, welcome. This is the Department of Health's intergovernmental subcommittee meeting. We're having a public hearing and open session agenda in order to review some of the mandates given before this committee. First let me see. Can we call the meeting to order? Do we have a quorum?
Yes.
So, you know, I just want to remind the public and thank everyone for coming that this is, again, an advisory committee, and what we take will be used to evaluate the recommendation that we put forward. So, first, if we can just quickly announce who we are, and we'll just go around the room. And, you know, this was the biggest room we got, so I apologize for the formality, but I like to run things a little bit informal. So I guess we'll just start over here to my right, down on the end.
Hi, I'm Matt Orland, and I'm here as a representative of the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs.
Good evening. My name is Melanie Bell, and I'm here with the Office of the City Administrator.
And I'm Rick Beta. I'm the chair of this subcommittee and the senior deputy director for the Department of Health Regulation and Licensing Administration.
Good evening. Carla Williams, Assistant Attorney General and Legal Advisor for the Advisory Committee.
Good evening. I'm Kelly O'Meara. I'm the Director of Strategic Change for the Metropolitan Police Department.
Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Philip Husband, General Counsel of the Department of Health.
Trish D'Antonio, Program Manager for Pharmaceutical Control.
Corinne Barron, Health License Specialist.
Great. That covers everyone. And again, so what we'll do, so if I can just quickly review the agenda, we're going to just, again, I understand it's a public hearing and I don't want to waste anyone's time. We're just going to go through the approval of the minutes, give some brief program updates for the medical marijuana program. Carla will briefly review our hearing procedures, and then really the interest of this meeting is to hear from the public. And so, again, I appreciate everyone who came. So first, can we approve the minutes? Have you had a chance to review? Is there a motion to approve them?
So moved. Seconded.
Okay, all in favor of the meeting approval? Yeah.
Aye.
Great. Thank you. The minutes have approved. So at this time, I'll turn it over to Trish to give any program updates, if any.
Thank you. So in your packet, you'll see that we have information as far as the medical marijuana program update. We have 452 patients registered as of last Thursday. There are 17 caregivers registered. We have a breakdown. As you know, we had new conditions that were added to the rulemaking, and at this point, we've only had two patients who are part of those conditions. So that's ALS, cachexia, Alzheimer's disease, seizure disorder, and I'm going to forget the last one.
That's okay.
So we have that information here. The department notified, we were going through our round two of applications, and we notified two applicants that they are eligible to register as dispensaries. Now at this time, that's up to those dispensaries to complete what they need to do and get their certificate of occupancy, and then the Department of Health will conduct a pre-opening inspection. We also testified at hearings last week with City Council with respect to two laws that are before them. One, with regard to cultivation centers and the plant count, increasing that from 95 plants to 500 plants. And the second legislation was that the decision about a medical marijuana recommendation would be between the physician and the patient. So do you have any questions, or is there anything else about that?
No. Well, I'll turn it over to the panel. Do you have any questions regarding the program? Okay, great. I just want to reiterate, Trisha, I think the program's doing a great job. I think we're on track. I also, although we're here for a specific purpose, if there's any comments related to some of the improvements, I'm always open to hear that. We've tried to make electronic or make ease of access for both patients and physicians to register online, and I think that's helped, sort of ease the process. We'll also be putting up some informational documents on our website soon, walking folks, regardless of which entity you are that you would be regulated under, to help better explain the process. So from our end, we're trying to ease the regulatory aspect. So great job, and thank you for that. So at this time, I'm just going to turn it over. And again, really the heart of this is to have the public hearing to hear from the public on our mandates. I just want to have Carla briefly go over our hearing procedures for today.
Thank you. So at this point, the subcommittee needs to adopt the procedures. You were presented this information at our last meeting to review. So I will go over it, and then the subcommittee is used to vote about these procedures. So not only for today, but for all public portions of meetings before the Intergovernmental Subcommittee, the procedures will be that for general comments, the committee may provide for public comment period at its meetings. The public comment may be written, verbal, or both. Members of the public may submit unlimited written testimony. Verbal comments shall be limited to 3 minutes per person and 5 minutes per panel, unless at his or her discretion the chair determines that because of the number of members signed up to testify or to speak, less time will need to be allocated per speaker in order to accommodate all speakers. The time taken for the subcommittee members' questions and responses thereto shall be in addition to the time allotted for the individual or panel members' verbal comments. Speakers are entitled to the floor only when recognized by the chair. The chair should alert the speaker when his or her allotted time has nearly expired. If the allotted time ends before the speaker has concluded his or her presentation, the chair should advise the speaker to complete his or her final remarks and conclude the presentation. In the event that the speaker chooses not to conclude the presentation after being asked to do so, the microphone could be turned off to end the presentation. When the speaker's presentation concludes, the chair may ask the speaker to remain at the podium for questions from the subcommittee members. Speakers, to the greatest extent possible, should testify on the subject matter under consideration. The chair may restrict or terminate a speaker's right to the floor for intemperate or abusive behavior or language. When there is a hearing such as today, each individual or association of individuals who request to be heard shall limit their verbal testimony to 5 minutes, unless at his or her discretion the chairperson determines that time should be limited to adjust because of the number of speakers signed up to testify. For the purpose of questioning the witnesses before the Intergovernmental Subcommittee, the first round of questioning shall be 5 minutes unless the members agree to a longer or shorter time period. The chair shall decide whether to allow for additional rounds, and the time allowed for each committee member to question during those rounds. A witness may be questioned with the consent of the chair or presiding member, by the subcommittee staff, or by counsel advising the committee. And the chair shall conduct the hearing so as to provide a reasonable opportunity for all interested persons to be heard without making the hearing unreasonably lengthy or cumbersome or burdening the record with unnecessary repetition. These procedures may be amended by a vote of majority of the subcommittee members. So at this point, it is...
Yeah, no, thank you. And again, this is just procedure on formality. So do I have a motion to adopt the minutes? I mean, I'm sorry, for the procedures?
So moved.
Thanks. Is there a second?
Seconded.
Excellent. All in favor?
Aye.
Great. Thanks. Thank you, Carla. I appreciate it. Okay, so let's get to the heart of why we're here. And again, we'll try to, our goal is to accommodate everyone, to get everyone's testimony in today while being mindful of the time that we have this room until, and allowing for everyone to have equal chance to speak. What I just want to briefly go over, the reason why we're here. Again, this is the intergovernmental group. This is distinguished from the scientific subcommittee, and it's really our mandate here to make recommendations as to, one, whether to recommend to the mayor and the council to increase the quantity of medical cannabis a patient may receive in a 30-day period, not to exceed 4 ounces, as necessary to constitute an adequate supply for qualified patients. And second, whether to recommend to the mayor and the council to allow qualifying patients and caregivers to cultivate medical marijuana in the District of Columbia through the process commonly known as home growing. So if possible, I could limit the, you know, your testimony and for, to provide some insight into those things. So at this time, I'd like to call up Olivia Johnson,
yes, sir.
Xavier Butler, and Joshua Kahn, please. And Paula Kahn, too, if you like, if you have like to join.
Old. I'm a resident of the District of Columbia. I'm originally from California, and I had experiences with the medical marijuana program in California. I believe one of the main reasons I'm here is the amount allowed per month per patient is definitely not enough. In my own situation, some months, like the winter months, I need more of the medication because my disorder is affected by weather and barometric pressure. Sometimes I'm not able to purchase any more in the month because I've reached my maximum allocation, and it leaves me in a very precarious position as far as my health is concerned. I also have concerns that I'm also concerned that there's not enough for the patients, and some of the patients might fall to the wayside and do other things that they don't need to do because they're not allowed to get the proper amounts. In my opinion, my personal opinion, I feel it should be in the hands of the doctors to determine how much a patient needs per month through medical providers. My own situation is I'm a recovering crack addict. I've been clean from crack for over 19 years. And the traditional medical recommendations include narcotics such as Oxycontin, Percodan, Percocet, those types of things that I really don't want to get involved with for the fact that it might trigger me back to my addiction. And medicinal marijuana is my miracle drug. Thank God for it. And thank you all for letting me speak today.
Great, thank you. And we'll just hear the testimony of the panel, and then I'll proceed with questions.
Good evening. My name is Joshua Kahn, and my family and I own and operate Tacoma Wellness Center, the medical marijuana dispensary in Ward 4. I want to thank the Department of Health and the members of the Intergovernmental Subcommittee for the opportunity to speak this evening. I speak in favor of raising the monthly or 30-day limit of medicine from 2 ounces to 4. I could quote statistics from different states, such as Arizona's very successful medical marijuana program that allows 2.5 ounces every 14 days. I could remind you of the Federal Compassionate Investigational New Drug Program that sends patients 9 ounces a month from the University of Mississippi. I could tell you of the ALS patient in Washington State who requires 5 ounces a month and would not survive in the limits we have. But after nearly a year in operation, serving about one-third of the district's nearly 500 patients, I don't have to tell you about experiences of strangers around the country. I could tell you about the residents of the District of Columbia, our neighbors, people we know and respect, who find the current 30-day limit too restrictive. Yes, people participating in our program today cannot get all of their needs met. Not every patient, not even most. Most of our patients, about two-thirds of them, remain well within the current limit. Raising the limit will not affect them in any way. But about one-third of our patients, around 50 people, are struggling with the limits of the program. We cannot fully meet their needs because they need more than 2 ounces a month. And when they run out, they either have to go without or find their medicine elsewhere, sometimes for as long as 2 weeks. None of our patients should be forced to go without their meds for even a day because the limits of the program are too restrictive to meet their medicinal needs, their medical needs. And the restrictive limits make the 30 days difficult for patients and dispensary owners to calculate. It's easy for people who have the means to come in once a month and purchase 2 ounces and then know the following month they can come and purchase 2 ounces again. But a patient who comes in for 2 grams on one day, the next time 4, the next day 1, 2 days later 7, when their purchases are dictated by finances rather than medicinal need, the number is difficult to track. People are often frustrated and embarrassed when they come to get their medicine in the 3rd and 4th week and we have to turn them away. And we are frustrated and embarrassed as well. Our DC medical marijuana law allows for 2 ounces every 30 days, with the mayor empowered by law to increase that number to 4. It was smart to begin with 2 ounces and to see if there was a need to increase that number. Patient need for the increase is there. Some of our patients are testifying at this hearing, and I know that you'll be impressed and moved with what they have to say. Tonight, I speak for the dozens who cannot be here but need that limit raised so that they have safe and legal access to all the medicine they need. Please help us serve our patients better. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am grateful for this opportunity to speak before the public and the Department of Health Medical Marijuana Programs Intergovernmental Subcommittee. Thank you. My name is Paula Carrito Khan, and I am Director of Community Engagement at Tacoma Wellness Center, DC's family-run medical marijuana dispensary. I'd like to address both increasing the monthly limit and home growing. On increasing the monthly limit from 2 ounces up to 4 per 30 days, there are a host of reasons why patients sometimes have difficulty staying within the 2 ounce per month limit. Symptom management combined with individual physiology and tolerance to the medicine can lead to a need for more than the 2 ounce per month. A person with HIV, for instance, may have been using marijuana as medicine for years to improve appetite and reduce nausea. The need for the medicine doesn't diminish when the patient hits the monthly allotment. A person with seizure disorder or glaucoma may need to medicate consistently throughout the day to keep symptoms at bay. With the current limit, patients are not able to get the medicine they need legally and safely. The rolling 30 days confuses patients who, for financial or other personal reasons, may prefer to purchase small amounts on a frequent basis, not realizing, in fact, that their symptom management requires more medicine than the set limit until they hit the limit. And at that point, voice anger, frustration, confusion, even feeling a sense of discrimination regarding this system and the rules. Finally, in the effort to find the just right fit of strains, methods of ingestion, and dosage, patients who are novice users of marijuana as medicine are reaching the 2 ounce limit during the process of learning how to best use the medicine to meet their individual needs. So due to the current limited level of physician education combined with the recommendation versus prescription procedure in DC and many other states, the patient is empowered to work together with knowledgeable dispensary operators to find exactly what does work. Different methods of ingestion require varying amounts of medicine to reach effective symptom management. At times, this investigative process puts patients over the 2 ounce limit, though they may still be in need of more medicine to manage their symptoms that month. Regarding home growing, the significant health benefit noted by doctors and patients alike regarding daily ingestion of the juice of fresh marijuana plant leaves. For many of our patients struggling with chronic illness, home growing provides access to fresh plant juicing. in raw form, marijuana leaves and buds contain non-psychoactive, antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, anti-cancer nutrient compound known as CBD that is proven to be a superfood and reported to be capable of preventing and reversing a host of chronic illnesses. It does seem that it may be challenging to provide this juice in the dispensary in the current system for the foreseeable future. It would require daily juicing by a cultivation center with daily deliveries of fresh juice and then daily visits from the patients, which may prove a hardship in the long run. As well, for issues of finances for people in the district who are extremely low income, the ability to grow a few plants in the home may allow those people to have regular access to this life-changing medicine. Thank you again for your time and consideration.
Great, thank you very much. So I'll start with questions and then turn it over to the panel members for their questions as well. So if I may start with you, Ms. Johnson, and I appreciate your testimony. When you've met with your physician, so your physician has recommended to you to use more than 2 ounces for your condition?
Sometimes, yes. It's based, a lot of my disorder has to do with weather, barometric pressure, and like in the colder months, yes, he has said, why don't you get some more? And I'm like, because I'm at my limit. And he's like, that's not fair. I should make that decision. It's just like I write a prescription for birth control or a prescription for another pain management type pill. Why don't I have the right to do that? I said, I don't know. So I'm going based on that. That my physician at certain times has said I needed more than what is actually available to me that particular month.
Okay. Thank you. If I may, Ms. Khan, what exactly is your take on home growing then? So do you feel that it should be permissible, but only for certain forms of meaning for juicing?
Well, the juicing would be if the marijuana plant has leaves when it grows, and as well as the buds, which the bud is the flower that we then sell in our dispensary. The leaves are disposed of in the case of the cultivators. The leaf is what is the thing that is most difficult to access in this program for a patient who would like to find the benefit of the raw plant. There is, in California, specifically a doctor, Dr. William Courtney, who's doing a lot with juicing and patients finding a lot of health benefit by regular daily juicing. Like, you know, that's not unfamiliar with other vegetables, but this is something you would add to enhance that, and people finding remarkable effects. I wouldn't know how to say otherwise to define the home growing situation.
Okay, great. So in your experience, have you, and this question may be for both of you, do you feel that there may be any additional measures that you take to prevent your product from any security concerns that home growing may not have, or do you feel like that from a security angle there's no particular issues?
I mean, patients are educated through the Department of Health and through our dispensary about the rights and responsibilities of being a patient in the program, which includes discussion of diversion of medication and other things. That may be an issue but may be easily addressed through the Department of Health level of education as the patient becomes a patient in the program with home growing.
Okay, great. Mr. Khan, to you, as we heard from Ms. Johnson, she feels that the amount should be dependent on between a physician and a patient. I'm assuming some patients come in requesting less or purchasing less, but some are coming in purchasing more. In your opinion, what would be an allowable amount, if any?
I believe the possibility of expanding the limits to 3 or to 4 ounces would be acceptable. Those that do not need more won't need to purchase more. However, those that are experimenting with, let's say, a vaporizer, but when you vaporize the medicine as opposed to smoking it, it is much healthier. However, they will need to use more of the medicine. And we offer around 15 different strains from the 3 different cultivators here in D.C., and new patients like to experiment, to try one strain to see how it makes them feel, and then try a different strain. And it will be unfortunate if a patient has to look at this as, I can't experiment, I can't see what will work for me best, because it's going to affect my limit. And if they buy a few grams from one strain and they don't like it, that affects their limit. They might not be able to buy another strain. And again, we are selling tinctures. The cannabis is infused in grain alcohol. That affects their limit. So they could try one, and they might not like it. But that's, their limit has been affected. They have to wait a whole other month.
Great, thank you. I'm going to turn it over to the panel now for questions. We can just start here for Kelly.
Thank you. I wanted to start out, Ms. Johnson. Rick actually asked a question I was going to ask about your doctor, but I did want to thank you so much for coming to testify today. Do you know if your doctor would be willing, I don't know if there are other doctors in the audience today, but would be willing to talk with us some about that?
I can ask. I can ask. I can't speak for him, but
Of course. We would be, I think, encouraged to hear from some doctors about what they see their role in this.
Yes. As I said, I don't think he would have a problem, but I can't speak for him.
Of course.
I'm sure if we invited him, he would be glad to come.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. So then we can get your contact information afterwards and follow up with you. We really appreciate your coming in. Particularly since we've had the pleasure of talking with a number of the people involved in the business side, but not so many patients, so we appreciate it.
Yeah, well, like I said, being involved in the program in Los Angeles, I was there when it first took off, and if I may say this, I know it's kind of not related, but the financial gain the public school systems gained when the limits were raised was enough to help bring the grade point average up in the whole state of California. When you're raising grade point averages, that's our future, and I think that it all has something to do with it, the way that the product is taxed here. It can be, the more you sell, the more you make. And if it's going toward a proper, you know, venue like education, I think, or, you know, police education, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, as long as it's doing some good, why is it being limited? And why isn't there a doctor, you know, discussing with...
We absolutely agree. We would love to hear some more from the medical community.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah, because like I said, they can write a prescription for me for OxyContin, which I really don't want. I'm very terrified of it. Never had to take it. Don't hope I never will take it, but I'm afraid of the addictive process because I have an addiction problem, and I'm a recovering addict till the day I die. I can't say I'm no longer a crackhead. I'm just a recovering crackhead. And like I said, it's very important for me to avoid those triggers. Mm-hmm. And medicines that conventional doctors want to prescribe to you, that's all that they just want. Take this pill. No, I can't do that. In my situation, I know what my problem is, and I know what I need to do to manage my pain properly.
Well, we're glad you found that.
Yeah.
That's definitely the patient care is what we're here to talk about, so we appreciate that. Thank you for coming as well. I had a question for you, Mr. Khan. You mentioned that about a third of your patients are reaching the limit. Do you have any sense of, that seems really loud to me, do you have any sense of what conditions, are there commonalities of the patients that are reaching the limit?
Still, mainly I see it with insomnia and lack of appetite. And with those two issues, it's not easy to find the perfect dose that someone will need to take before they go to sleep. We have one patient that struggles with insomnia constantly, and he cooks the medicine into cookies. And that also takes a lot more in that process. and he actually was just talking about his wife made the cookies, and they were horrible. So he didn't want to eat them. And so he came back, and he told the story, and said, I can't sleep. The cookies were horrible. I'm going to make them this time. But he reached his limit. So he had to wait another 30 days before he could purchase again.
Mrs. Kahn, thank you. Good to see you again. So very interested in part of your testimony. You mentioned, if we can move to the home growing, that some doctors and patients have noted the health benefits of the juicing. Are there any studies or anything that we can refer to or articles?
That's a good question. I will do some more research. From what I found, it's largely anecdotal. I've seen videos of patients' testimonies about the benefits that they receive that to their physical health. But in terms of research, I'm yet to find exactly that.
Anything you can share, if you could send her like
sure,
that.
Sure, will do.
Thank you. And then, do you have any concerns about how patients at home might have quality control issues and dosage issues through home growth?
Quality control, I would imagine, which is, I think that the majority of people seeking marijuana as medicine will do it through the DC regulated system. It would be a smaller amount, I would imagine, that would go towards home growing for a variety of reasons, one of them being quality control. And dosage, I think that, I mean, it's in the hand of the patients as it is to figure out dosage, along with with the knowledge of the dispensary operators. But so to a degree, they're already empowered in that way.
Sure. I think that if home growing was an option, I think it would have to be part of this program, where that the patient would need to go through the dispensary. In the regulations so far, they wouldn't be able to go through a cultivator, so they would have to purchase any sort of books or ingredients, anything like that, through the dispensary. And I think it would add another level to ensure that there is quality control, to ensure that the patients are growing in a way that was safe and that was healthy. And it definitely would add another layer to that.
Thank you. Thank you, all three of you.
Thank you, Kelly. Turn it over to Melanie. Do you have any questions?
First, I would like to thank you for your testimony. It's very helpful, and we appreciate you taking the time to come today. I had just one follow-up. You all hit on some of my questions. For Mr. Kahn or Ms. Kahn, in terms of the patients that you see, how many or what percentage would you say, estimated, are working with their physician in terms of, their physician recommending that type of treatment?
It varies. Some patients don't feel comfortable talking to their physicians about marijuana. They did write a recommendation, but it's new territory. Sometimes their doctors did it, but they don't necessarily feel comfortable talking with them. Others do. Others are their own advocates, and they speak to their doctors about their dosing, about exactly what they're doing. But it really depends on the patient.
Okay. Do any physicians, just out of curiosity, just contact you all to, just increase their knowledge regarding the subject and the treatment? And
all the time. And I think that, and Paula, I want to add, we get phone calls from physicians almost daily that are looking for more information. Believe that there's a lack of quality information out there, and I know that the Department of Health has the ability to further that education, but as of right now, that doesn't necessarily exist. So they do reach out to the different dispensaries to ask questions and speak with them daily.
Really, there's a handful of doctors in the district, it seems, to my estimation, that are more educated about marijuana as medicine, about the endocannabinoid system in the body. They've self-educated about that. And others who are being educated by their patients at requesting this. And I think it's growing and changing every day, that need and desire of physicians to know more.
Thank you.
Great, thanks. Matt?
Hi. Once again, I want to thank everyone, all of the witnesses here today, for taking time out to come share your thoughts with us. It is extremely valuable as we consider our recommendations to get perspective from both operators and patients. So my first question would be for Ms. Khan. With respect to the juicing, do you have any sense of how much marijuana you might need to be growing at home in order to be doing the daily juicing that you described?
A couple of plants is what I've read. It doesn't require a lot. It just, you need plants that are fresh to have the fresh leaf to be able to put in your juicer. Because for us, to get the leaves from the cultivator, it becomes dry in the process. So it's a couple of plants that don't necessarily even need flower buds on them, but the leaf is there for that possibility.
Do you happen to know if this is in widespread use in any other jurisdictions at this point?
I've heard about it mostly in California, potentially in Colorado, but that definitely California.
So this is for either Mr. or Ms. Khan. When you're working with patients to help them determine what the appropriate dosage might be for their respective conditions, can you describe what that process looks like? I know it may be different for each patient, but just in a general way.
To every patient, I recommend to start with the smallest dose you can imagine, so that you begin from square one and you use as little as possible to manage the symptom you're looking for. There is, in fact, research suggesting that dosage does not need to be high to affect pain and a lot of the symptoms patients are trying to manage. And even as dosages increase, you can have an opposite effect, where at one level you have decrease in perception of pain, and at an extremely high dose you might have some other perception. So we always recommend to start with the smallest dose and go from there to see what you need to manage your symptoms. And then also throughout the day, what are the times of day that you need to medicate for your issues? Some people have a hard time getting out of bed in the morning due to pain from muscle spasms, alongside depression and whatever else may be going on. So some patient uses it first thing in the morning to even start their day and get out of pain to be able to get out of bed. Other patient, it's nighttime. So we discuss both the amount and the times of day that patients are medicating.
So this question would be for all three of the witnesses. All of your testimony echoed the sentiment that 2 ounces is insufficient. While we're, as a subcommittee, only discussing whether to increase from 2 to something as high as 4, I wonder, is there a limit that could be set that you would think would be too high? Whether, you wouldn't have to be 4, but is there a threshold at which you would believe perhaps too much is being prescribed in a month?
Okay, I'm not the professional like they are, I'm just a patient, but from what I know and from my personal life experience, like people with dementia and Alzheimer's in California, they need to smoke a lot more than what somebody without that particular disease might have to smoke. Whereas another person may have another disorder like the wasting away syndrome caused by chemotherapy and radiation, that their needs need to be met. And like, especially during the initial process of people getting chemo and radiation, the nausea, the loss of appetite, and that can just cause, it can just snowball into a bunch of problems. In my personal opinion, I think it should be like a quarter pound a month per person, which would be 4 ounces a month. That's my personal opinion.
From what I understand through different states and the research that is available now, the talk of increasing the limit to 4 ounces, in other places 5 or 6, it seems to be the answer, the key for most patients. I have not read anywhere that a patient would need 50 ounces a month in order to feel to be properly medicated. So I think that it's appropriate, the limits that we're discussing today. And I think, and again, I think it was a wise decision to start with 2 ounces, and I believe that it would be a good decision to also expand it by 1 ounce and to evaluate that if it went from 2 to 3 ounces, and to evaluate that and
thank you.
Great. If there's no more questions, I just want to say thank you again for your testimony. So now I'll call up the next three witnesses. I believe is Xavier Butler, Amira Hickim, Steph Scherer, Michael Azuski, so we don't have Amira Hickam or Steph Scherer?
No, Steph will not be able to make it.
Okay, so then can we also have Robert Capucci and David Gard? Thank you, you may.
Thank you, members of the Intergovernmental Operations Subcommittee, for having us today to discuss these two potential changes to the DC Medical Marijuana Program. First, on behalf of Americans for Safe Access, I would like to thank the work of the subcommittee and really DOH as a whole for the improvements that have been made to the Medical Marijuana Program in the past 6 months. We've really been happy with a lot of the changes we've seen and the greater attention that DOH seems to be paying to patients. And we see this program becoming much more successful, and we're really thrilled with the work that DOH has been doing. Slightly off topic from today, but I just want to give you all a quick update of what happened on the Hill today. As you all probably know, Congressman Andy Harris offered an amendment that would, initially, we thought it was going to have the same impact as the Barr Amendment and could potentially impact the DC medical program, but he changed the language at the last minute today, and it's only applying to the recreational program. So we can feel confident that we can still make changes to the medical program without congressional interference. Speaking to these two topics that we're here today for, ASA definitely thinks that patients should be able to cultivate their own medicine. This is one of the cornerstones to safe access, safe and legal access. It helps ensure a consistent access to particular strains. We know that there's at least 15 strains that are currently available here in the district, and that's great. But certain strains work better for certain patients. Even patients who have the same debilitating condition might react differently to different strains. And so the customization that personal cultivation helps enable is really an advantage. It also helps reduce the price of medicine for patients. One thing we got to keep in mind here is medical marijuana is not covered by health insurance, and patients who have trouble making ends meet, yes, they're eligible for the sliding scale, and that is helpful. And the district actually has one of the better sliding scale programs in the country. We're thankful for that. But this helps provide patients with a greater range of options. And as many have said earlier today, the juicing becomes much more of a feasible option when you're doing patient personal cultivation of your medicine. It's just the practical reasons. You need to have the fresh leaves on hand. From a practical perspective, doing this, we can accomplish this in the urban environment in D.C. We've seen places in California and elsewhere across the country successfully implement patient cultivation as part of their medical programs, even in urban environments. Some of the expertise that we've learned, 1,200 watts of lighting is probably a good amount for someone in an interior home or an apartment. Growing this would limit the cultivation space to about 50 square feet. It would only you'd only be able to grow a small amount of plants in this amount of space. So you would get the, if you limited it by the amount of wattage of lighting available, you'd have the dual advantage of keeping the safety of maintaining a relatively modern amount of wattage used, and also you wouldn't have too many plants being grown. So it would keep the program in a manageable range. And you know, we're happy to provide more detailed information on this in our written testimony we'll be submitting later this week. Turning to the possession limit, again, for many of the aforementioned reasons that the last panel mentioned, we support increasing the possession limit. There are currently 13 states that allow for greater possession than the District of Columbia. So the district, well, it's about in the middle, but it's on the lower end of what is out there currently right now. One of the reasons why 2 ounces every 30 days is too restrictive is if you break this down into grams, and a gram is about, it's a large, if a patient uses a joint to consume their medicine, a gram is about what one joint would be, give or take. Some patients would be a little bit smaller. But if they were using two of those a day, they would reach their limit by day 28 of the program. So they would have to wait at least two more days. So we're really not talking about a significant amount of medicine for patients to be using. And where this really could come into play is if a patient is using multiple strains to treat multiple conditions, say a patient has both severe pain and spasticity issues, one strain might work particularly well for the spasticity issues. A different strain might work better for the pain or for appetite stimulation. And so for patients to be able to have multiple strains available to treat multiple conditions, and again, for the patients who need this, we're really talking about our most vulnerable patients. They're going to need higher possession limits. You know, again, juicing is one of the reasons why we could potentially need higher possession limits. That might get to the usable cannabis language that's in the DC council law, so that might actually be more of a question for the council, but that's something that we would need to keep in mind. In an ideal world, physicians would be recommending the precise amounts to patients for their conditions, but there's a couple of reasons why this doesn't really work out in the real world. Right now, the physicians probably don't have the medical expertise to be recommending this quite in the same way as they would with a prescription medication. But also, the legal precedent that allows physicians to write medical cannabis recommendations doesn't allow them to do specific dosage. While we would really like that to be eventually how a program works, under the current regime, that's just, it's not possible. But we think that it's certainly viable and a good idea for the district to consider raising the possession limits to 4 ounces. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Good evening. Good evening. My name is Robert Kopecki. I'm with the Marijuana Policy Project. On behalf of MPP and the hundreds of seriously ill across the district, I'd like to thank the DOH and the Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee for your continued interest in shaping and fostering a compassionate and well-regulated program. It should probably come as no surprise that Marijuana Policy Project supports both the proposals on the table today, both increasing the patient's 30-day supply from 2 to 4 ounces and allowing properly registered patients to privately cultivate their own medicine. As was brought up many times, the increase from 2 to 4 ounces per 30 days will put the district more in line with many of the other medical marijuana jurisdictions across the country. For instance, states like Arizona, Illinois, Maine, Nevada, and Rhode Island, patients there may obtain 2.5 ounces every 14 or 15 days. So roughly 4 to 5 ounces every 30. Other states have higher limits but have longer supplies. So in Washington, it's a 60-day supply as opposed to a 30-day supply. So we strongly urge the recommendation to the executive branch to increase the possession from 2 to 4. As far as home cultivation, everything that I wanted to say has been said, so I will just also point out that the initiative that district voters approved of overwhelmingly in 1998 did allow personal cultivation, and it also did not set possession limits or distribution limits, so this would be putting the law more in line of what the district voters, you know, overwhelmingly said they wanted their program to be. Thank you much. I'll take time for questions when appropriate.
Great, thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. I appreciate your efforts on behalf of DC's medical marijuana program and the patients it serves. I'm here today to discuss the proposed increase in the quantity of medical cannabis a patient may receive, and I hope I can provide some insight into how this change will benefit many patients in the program. Since opening its doors on July 29th of last year, Capital City Care has proudly served approved patients in the District of Columbia. Performing this work is a privilege for us, and each day we're able to witness the impact our efforts as we observe firsthand the medical benefits provided to patients suffering from debilitating illnesses. We've seen MS patients improve their mobility and even learn to walk again. We've seen HIV patients improving their appetite, their strength, and their overall quality of life. We have glaucoma patients reporting reduced intraocular eye pressure and pain. We have observed cancer patients overcoming their illness to the delight of their doctors, family, and friends with medical marijuana as a constant source of help and comfort along the way. Throughout this process, we have diligently monitored the amount of medicine each patient receives to ensure full legal compliance. For most patients, most of the time, the current permitted quantity has been sufficient. However, we have found that dozens of the patients we serve have not been able to adequately meet their individual needs under the current 56-gram limit. Frankly, we worry about the lengths that patients may go to in order to satisfy their medical needs, considering we cannot assist them. In our experience, several factors can contribute to insufficient care under the current limit. In some cases, patients suffering from severe pain, spasticity, or appetite loss simply require more than 2 grams per day in order to address their symptoms. In such cases, the patient reaches their purchase limit before the 30 days have passed and must go without treatment until enough time passes that a compliant purchase can be made. This is an agonizing experience, and its impact is felt primarily by patients whose medical circumstances are the most difficult to endure. We've also found that many patients whose needs are ordinarily addressed adequately under the current limit can sometimes lapse into temporary periods of more severe discomfort brought on by their condition. Because patients cannot always anticipate the onset of more severe symptoms, they are unable to plan ahead and conserve medicine for their time of greatest need. Many patients have told us that the option of purchasing larger quantities would be comforting, even though they do not typically require more than 2 grams per day. Finally, many of our patients prefer to produce their own edible preparations as an alternative to smoking, and because the effects last a bit longer, which is very important to those trying to get restful sleep. Preparing edibles requires larger quantities of cannabis, which is typically infused into butter or oil and used for baking. Patients who rely on this option have often reported to us that the current limit poses an obstacle to producing an adequate supply of edibles. Because edible preparations offer a healthy and effective method of ingesting medical cannabis, we would love to be able to provide more to support patients who prefer this approach. Increasing the limit to 4 ounces would be an important and positive step in our view. Would significantly improve the quality of care available to the patients who are suffering the most. Should such a change take effect, we will continue to carefully monitor our sales activity to ensure full compliance with all program rules. I appreciate the committee's time, and I'm happy to provide any further information as needed. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, all three of you, for your contribution and your testimony. Again, it's always a pleasure to hear from you, so thank you for coming. So I'll start with you, Mr. Blazewski. In your opinion from other states, has there been any issues on any, again, quality concerns related to home growing that you've heard of, or any other, you know, anecdotes for any safety concerns to patients related to that?
From a safety perspective, no. And, you know, obviously it's easier to do quality control in the type of setting in a cultivation facility. But patients have successfully been treating themselves through home cultivation without really any sort of widespread stories of difficulty. And as a matter of fact, this is the way that cannabis has been used as a medicine historically for centuries, is through the patient cultivation model. It's been viable.
Great. And to follow up on that, what type of regulatory role have you seen other states or your recommendations for the Department of Health or other governmental body to play in home growing, if any?
I think one jurisdiction to keep an eye on the district might want to do would be New Mexico. New Mexico requires a regulatory license for patients to cultivate, but they don't. Some other states require you must live a certain distance from a dispensary, or you must have a certain income requirement to do that. I mean, we think this should be an option for all patients, because it also, by having patients cultivate their own medicine, you relieve some tension for the supply of medicine off of the rest of those who are purchasing from dispensaries. So it relieves that tension as well. And that's one of the ways that New Mexico, which has a similar plant cultivation limit as D.C., but has significantly more patients, they've had some trouble. So as the district is considering adding new conditions, one way that we can alleviate concerns about the supply of medicine is to utilize patient cultivation.
Great. And so now, heard testimony right before yours that the decision on the amount should really be left between the patient and physician. Do you have any thoughts on that and what your recommendations are for, in general, for the amount?
Again, in sort of an ideal world, that probably would be the way that this would be done, that physicians would have the expertise to recommend certain amounts and for there to be the legal ability to do this. But given the federal law, physicians are allowed to write recommendations, but they're not allowed to write prescriptions, and the prescription, the recommendation can't talk about specific amounts. One thing some other states have done is to allow the presumptive level above for certain patients, if the physician recommends that the patient needs more than a presumptive amount. So that has been done in some states, but in terms of specific amounts, a physician can't recommend that. We think 4 ounces is probably an appropriate area. Massachusetts recently determined a 60-day supply would be 10 ounces, so and that seems about fair. We prefer the Oregon and Washington state approach, which takes a 60-day supply as 24 ounces presumptively, but we think that if the district were to embrace a 4 ounce possession limit, that would probably benefit most patients in the district. The patients that need 24 ounces in a 60-day period, it is a small amount of the patient population, but those people do exist. And we recognize this. The law only allows that slide up to 4 ounces, and we think that would be appropriate, but it would probably be wise to take a look at the higher amounts in the future as well.
Great, thanks. And so, I was doing a little bit of math. You said 1 gram equals one joint, 28 grams in an ounce, so 56 joints, really. Now, how much, in general, I think smoking, no matter what, is a public health concern as well. So you're saying that other forms that would be produced, such as edibles or whatnot, would require a higher amount?
Yes, it typically takes more the dried flowered form of cannabis, either through vaporization, usually requires more to get the same amount as smoking, or both, or edibles as well. It usually requires a larger amount to produce either the butter or the oil to infuse whatever food that you would be making with it. As you can see, it's the 2 ounce limit per month. It's pretty easy for patients to get up to that 2 ounces without using a substantial amount of medicine on a daily basis.
Thanks. Just a couple questions for you, Mr. Kopecky. Did I pronounce it right this time? So, would your recommendations be
you know, 2 ounces you mentioned every 30 days is insufficient. But your comments are specific to the frequency of availability as well as the amount as well. So what you're stating is, how much are you stating is a good limit in terms of the frequency? So for example, your recommendations would be a certain amount within a 15-day period versus a 30-day period?
Well, I'm not sure you have to tie it to a specific time period. Either way, I guess I was just pointing out that in Rhode Island and other states, they tie it to a different time period, 14 days at 2.5 months. So, or excuse me, 2.5 ounces at 14 days. So if you double that up, that's 5 ounces, roughly every 30 days. So it would be this proposed change would be more in line with that. If you're going to do a 30-day supply and you're going to cap it, I would think that 4 or 5 ounces would be sufficient. I agree wholeheartedly with Mike, though, that there should be allowance for physicians to tell the department or whomever that individual patients may require more than that cap. And for those individuals, there should be exceptions made.
Okay, thanks. And I guess maybe more specifically, my question was, and maybe this is for any of the panelists, there's a difference between saying 2 ounces every 15 days versus 4 ounces in 30 days, you know, where you're limiting 2 ounces within 15 days versus someone who can go on the first day of a month and purchase all 4 ounces. Has there been any, you know, security issues or usage issues or anything that you guys could comment on which would be make sort of what you've seen in best practices make more sense, or is it somewhat irrelevant?
If I could, one of the things that concerns us with the gram limitations is that, and I think the cons did a great job talking about how the patients would come in and purchase small amounts due to economic reasons or other reasons. Frankly, what happens is they end up in this cycle where they're unable, if they do have the means, to purchase a larger amount, in which you get a bulk amount, which you can spend less money than to get per gram. And so some of our patients don't realize this. They end up getting a paycheck and want to come in and buy an ounce and save money, and they can't because they may only have 26.5 grams left. So upping that limit's a wonderful thing because most people won't use it. But here and there, when they need to and they have the money and the means, they can save themselves some money, and it is not, you know, covered by health insurance. So this is important.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. There are individuals are compensated on different schedules. For instance, I'm paid monthly. I know my wife is paid every 2 weeks. You know, it's a matter of individuals' situation, whether or not when and if they can purchase their medicine. So,
okay. Yeah, as an organization, ACIP doesn't support purchase limits, but one possible example to look at would be Delaware, where they have a 6 ounce possession limit, but you're only allowed to purchase 3 ounces every 30 days. So something perhaps in the district on the order of, upping the possession limit at all times to 4 ounces, but a 2 ounce purchase limit every 14 days might accomplish the same effect, and that would probably reasonably balance the interest here, but I don't know if it's necessary to take that approach.
One more thing I'll add, which may get more directly to the question. I have not heard of any issues with allowing purchasing a specific amount every 14 versus every 30 days that's resulted in any kind of effects, negative or positive. It's kind of seems to be just the way it goes in some states. So,
okay. Great. Thank you. And a quick question for Mr. Garden related to Capital City Care. Do you think increasing the limit would create any supply chain concerns or any changes in the regulations?
Well, with the current patient load we have now, I think the plant limitations are almost being met. You know, the supply demand is really getting that breaking point. I think that's why the council is looking at extending it to 500 plants. Frankly, there's only so many patients that would actually. The cons mentioned they had about a third of their patients that were reaching their. That's about where we're at too. I think it's slightly less than that for us. So we really don't anticipate, you know, a lot of patients, you know, doing that. When it comes to going over a 4 gram limit, or I'm sorry, a 4 ounce limit, I am aware of these patients in the IND program that the federal government runs, and I have actually met a few of them, and it is true they really do need that amount. In rare occasions, I think you're going to find people that need 6 ounces, 7 ounces, but I think that can be met by maybe a petition process
to where you can really interact with that particular patient. That patient can explain to you really specifically why maybe their doctor even gets involved in it, and you feel better, you know, and more comfort about that.
Thank you. I'll turn it over to the panel.
Thank you. Thanks again for coming in. We appreciate your expertise on this issue. Several of us really don't have that expertise, and so we're relying on a lot of education from the public. I do have a few questions, starting with Mr. Gard. So, you know, when we talk about ounces and we're talking about people reaching their maximum, we're really talking about a specific type of product, but there are other types available as well. Do you find that patients might, for instance, look to hash, you know, which is more concentrated, in order to stay within their limit, when really their treatment would be better served through plant material?
It's funny you say that, and I should have brought you. You're making a great point for us. That actually happens. They come in and they say, "Well, I'm here. I'm getting this limit. What can I do?" And I say, "Well, go for the hash. It's you know, slightly more potent," and they just don't like it. You know, some people are just not hash smokers. It smokes a little bit differently. It's, you know, maybe a little bit stronger on the pull, and they're just not there. And that's a great reason why they would really appreciate the change. Yeah.
And have you seen it in other states, any other way to quantify it? I mean, clearly we see that the district, you know, I know you talked about the referendum. Well, the referendum didn't get to sort of the details of the program. They don't. People standing in a voting booth can't read, and, you know, all through details of a program. Is ounces the right way to be looking at this, or is there another way to identify quantity limits that would bridge the different types of product that there are?
I can't personally think of one. I mean, to me, that's been such a standard, and that's the way people, you know, think about this as they move forward. It's true, the one thing that happens as well, someone brought up the concept of you know, a gram of one thing is not a gram of another. And in fact, even within the same plant, or the same strain, I should say, you may have a batch that comes out slightly weaker, you know, or slightly stronger than it. That's why we test. You know, they make us go through all the testing and label each package with that. So that's where it gets a little hairy too, because somebody that might be used to smoking Master Kush and right up to their limit, maybe there's out on the market maybe a slightly less effective, you know, version of that out, and then they really reach their limit, and then they're in pain, you know, so all the more reason to have this up to 4 ounces.
If you wanted to chime in there, please.
Sure. I know states like Washington set different weight limits for whole plant marijuana versus infused edibles or infused products in liquid form, but it's all done by weight as opposed to any other metric, as far as I know. Mark?
And again, New Mexico is a state that's starting to look at how to do this, and they sort of come up with this unit system. It's in their proposed regulations, and to be quite honest, we think it's a good first attempt that they've made, but it's fairly flawed. But there's ways of doing this, and you can, you know, get pretty good equivalencies of, you know, for concentrates of THC amounts, and make some sort of equivalent to what the average dried flower has, and you can get some pretty good equivalency. It gets a little bit more difficult with edibles. One of the issues with edibles is, do you do the testing of the THC at the beginning stage or the end stage? It's a lot easier to do the testing at the beginning stage, but the final product may have significantly less THC and therefore significantly less medicinal effect, but that testing is a little bit more complicated to achieve. So it becomes a little bit more difficult when you're talking about edibles, but I think the solution could be found to come up with some sort of equivalencies.
Another issue that we're sort of grappling with is, I think, when you look at a lot of the other states that allow home cultivation, so turning to home cultivation, part of the significant part of the impetus behind it was to allow patients who don't live near a dispensary access to the product. So I think, you know, Nevada has the 25-mile limit. Obviously, that's not an issue here in D.C. Another issue is certainly the financial ones that you've raised. But it seems like that was a really strong push in other jurisdictions, and we just don't have that problem here. So beyond the financial reasons, what are other states looking at as reasons to justify the home cultivation?
Well, part of it is the ability to access specific strains. Part of it is the ability for juicing and to have the fresh leaves available. Part of it is it's simply to allow for consistent supply. Again, a patient might augment, a patient might both cultivate and purchase, and they might be using the cultivation to ensure that they have a steady supply. It's true, the rural patient issue doesn't really exist in here in D.C. We don't really have any rural areas. But there's certainly very good reasons to adopt a patient cultivation.
One last question. What guidelines might you see in other states to address concerns about juveniles having access to homegrown marijuana?
Well, there are already restrictions in place for diversion in the D.C. law. There are plenty of provisions in the various medical marijuana laws that have home cultivation. For instance, if patients are cultivating at home, it has to be in a secure, locked room, out of view of the public, for instance. I know that Rhode Island just amended their law to, they allow patients to cooperatively and privately cultivate a limited amount of marijuana, but if they're doing that cooperatively in a residential area, they've got to get they have to have a signed affidavit by a licensed electrician saying they inspected the, the unit or the home, and it's up to code and everything like that, so.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts on the juveniles? And it's a real concern here in this district.
Not at this time. I can investigate that a little more and see if there's been some issues in other states. I think one of the reasons I'm drawing a blank on it is just simply because I haven't encountered that as being a problem.
Yeah, to follow up on that, I haven't heard that home cultivation has led to any improper juvenile access. I mean, a lot of the stories that you hear of juveniles inadvertently using or obtaining marijuana, a lot of it is just people, apparently patients or parents, for instance, in Colorado, leaving it out and accessible. So that's an issue of education.
Okay, thank you. If you have any additional information, that'd be helpful.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, good evening. I just have one question. And my concern is a lot around the home cultivation. What has been your experience in terms of landlords, neighbors, and is it just because it can be cultivated outside as well as indoor, correct? So just in terms of managing those type of concerns, do you have any information on that?
It's actually easier to deal with the concerns of neighbors through indoor cultivation. You can utilize ventilation systems that essentially, there's no issues with potentially offensive odors, that sort of thing. So from that perspective, that's the least potential nuisance-inducing way of doing this. The disadvantage to that, though, is, and about half the dwelling units in the district are, I believe, houses and not apartments, so there are a significant number of properties here with yards, is if you do allow outdoor cultivation in an enclosed facility that has an open roof, you get the environmental advantage of not having the cultivation impact the electric bill and impact the patients that way. So that's actually the most affordable way to grow it. So there's certainly a balancing of interests there, but there's ways of doing it that don't offend other neighbors and potentially landlords.
There are also states that allow landlords to refuse to rent to individuals who wish to cultivate units on a landlord's property. In a lot of states, they have that absolute right to refuse to rent. Again, I mentioned a lot of states require home cultivation to be done indoors, in closed lock facilities, various things like that. And a lot of states, neighbors don't even know their
you know, their next door neighbor is a medical marijuana patient, and that's a good thing. You know, I don't want my neighbors to know all my health records as well, so.
Thank you.
Thank you. Matt?
Once again, thank you all for your time. Most of my questions have been covered by other panelists, so I'll stick with, I think, just one. So, we've talked a little bit about possession limits in other states. And one of the things I continue to be curious about is how any of the states arrived at those specific limits and determined those were the right amount. So, for example, with Washington and Oregon, you are looking at possession limits that seem to be, not possession, but distribution and possession limits that appear to be significantly higher than most other jurisdictions. Do you have any idea what sort of a rationale they used when they arrived at those limits or sort of what the analysis looked like?
I believe in Oregon it's statutory, and I'm not exactly sure the process there. In Washington State, and I may have these two states reversed in the order that they did this. In one of the states, it was a Department of Health determination, and the determination was through whatever process that they went up there was that there was a health basis for patients who would need up to 24 ounces in a 60-day period. A lot of the states, you know, to be quite honest, it's a balance between law enforcement diversion concerns and trying to meet patients' interests, and quite frequently we see it erring more on the side of caution than necessarily creating greater access. But you know, you see a state like Massachusetts, again, that's another Department of Health determined for 60 days, and they arrived at 10 ounces, so they didn't arrive at quite the same amount as Washington and Oregon. But they did something that's more in line with 4 ounces in 30 days that we were looking at.
It's interesting that Mike brings up Massachusetts and Washington. They're the states that I know for sure went through their departments of health to set this limit. A lot of the other states, particularly the ones who set it by statute, just kind of copied what other states were doing at the time. And that's why I see a lot that have 2 ounces every 14 days or 2.5 ounces every 14 days, because they looked at what the other medical marijuana states were doing and saw no need to reinvent the wheel, I suppose.
Thank you.
Great, thank you again for your testimony. So at this time, I've called everyone that was on the list. And again, I'll just revisit if there's a Xavier Butler or Mira Hickam available and would like to come and testify. If not, I do see some other members in the audience, and since we do have some time, at this time I'd like to offer if anyone else would like to come in and give a brief testimony or speak. Just please, if you could just raise your hand and come up if you would like to come up, if you have any, if there's anyone else from the public that has testimony. Please state your name and affiliation if you'd like for the record.
Okay. Good evening. My name is Shante Hopkins, and I run a program called Medical Marijuana Advocates Group and also a charity organization called Compassionate Alternatives. We work with quite a few of the patients, helping them to get registered and to have access to medical providers willing to write the recommendations for the program. So a lot of the questions that you were asking, I have hands-on experience with working directly with the doctors. I'm in the doctor's offices with, with patients. And I speak to patients, lots of patients, maybe 50 to 60 or more patients a week. And I work directly with the doctors who are treating these patients 3 to 4 days a week. So while I'm not a physician, I heard that actually, while you were asking the questions about bringing a physician in, one of the physicians that I work with was calling me. So he was calling me to let me know he couldn't come here, so I was hoping he could make it in time so he might be able to offer some testimony. To speak directly to the issue of whether or not the limits should be increased, I know working with the doctors and speaking with the patients on almost a daily basis, they do express the need to have more medication. Once we get the patients the card, they stay in touch with us. They call us if they're having issues with the dispensaries, and we work with them along with the doctors. We help to make sure that they maintain these relationships. We encourage that all of our patients maintain relationships. The law requires that they have the doctor-patient relationship, a bona fide relationship, and we always encourage that, you know, they do that and they see these doctors whenever they have issues that arise, not only from the medical marijuana, but just for continued treatment. And I'd say 80% of our patients who come to us for a recommendation to a doctor continue using this doctor as either primary care, or they switch to them for pain management. So the doctors continue treating these patients, so they get to know these patients very well. And so do we, because we continue to work with these patients as well. Like I said, we provide a lot of the financial assistance to help them access the program. For people who are low income and don't have the money to even pay the $25 that the doctor's charging for an administrative fee, our organization will take care of that for them, or we make arrangements to get that taken care of. So the patients are constantly expressing the need of, I'll give you one example. We go into senior citizen buildings, and we are arranging to actually bring doctors in to see these patients who are unable to get out. There's maybe 50 patients. Just recently we had a situation where we had 50 patients in one senior citizen home, and most of the patients were not able to get out and get to the doctor. So we started bringing doctors into these patients. And there's a major concern that a lot of these patients aren't going to be able to manage their symptoms with just 2 ounces per month. Some of the patients, I ask all of my patients when we work with them, are you currently using medical marijuana? Are you currently using marijuana? Obviously, before we help them get the cards, it's not legal, but they are using it. 99.5% of the patients that we work with are currently using marijuana, and they are using it quite a bit. And what we always say to patients is we want to ensure that they have safe, legal, and affordable access to the program. So we do whatever it takes to make sure they have that access. But the senior citizens, for example, that I've seen over the last couple weeks are saying that they're smoking quite a bit. As the cons mentioned, I have patients who cannot get out of bed. They're in so much pain. They're having spasms. And particularly the senior citizens, I have some concern about whether or not 2 ounces is going to be enough for these patients, because I find that they tend to be using more than the younger patients that we service. And we do service, the majority of the patients that we service are disabled. They are SSI, SSDI patients who are retired, military veterans who are disabled, and they truly are using quite a bit more than some of the younger patients who are maybe HIV positive. And I know a lot of them use it for appetite, but I'm finding that the disabled people and the older they are, they're just requiring more of the medication to manage their symptoms throughout the day.
Great, thank you. I really appreciate your testimony and for coming up. I don't have questions. I'm gonna give my time to the panel if there's
questions. Okay.
Thank you very much for coming forward to share this with us.
Yeah.
When you're speaking with the doctors, and I don't know, Rick, if the record's going to stay open for a few days after this, one of the things that I think we can do is accept written testimony, correct?
Okay.
Yes, and we have, actually we did receive written testimony for those that couldn't come here to testify, and the record does close tonight, but we can try to, if you have written testimony.
I think we would certainly encourage that if someone would be willing to submit written testimony as well. We appreciate your feedback on it, and also hearing from the doctors, I think, is something we'd really appreciate as well.
Yeah, that's definitely something I'm going to do, is speak to the doctors. Tomorrow I'll be in one of the doctor's offices that I work with, and I'll call a couple of the other doctors that I work really closely with to see if we can't get them to submit written testimony.
That would
on this
be great.
Subject.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And, just to follow on that, I mean, as we're deliberating and considering our evaluation, regardless of whether or not, you submit it for this or just send it to us for consideration, either way, we'll be putting it into consideration before we issue our recommendation. Thank you. Melanie?
Thank you for your testimony.
Sure.
I just want to make sure that we do get your contact information, since you are in touch with a lot of physicians, because that's an area that I'm very curious about and would like additional information.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you again for your testimony. I have no questions.
You're welcome, and thank you all for giving me the opportunity to speak tonight.
Sure, I appreciate it. Again, is there any other public witnesses that would like to come up and share any testimony before we conclude this public hearing? And again, you know, as I mentioned before, if you would like to submit written testimony for the consideration of the panel for our recommendation, we'll accept it outside of this. Okay, well, if there's nothing further, then I'll make a motion to conclude.
Second.
Great. And all in favor?
Aye.
Okay, great. So this concludes the public open session of the meeting, and pursuant to DC Official Code Section 2-575B, and for the purposes set forth therein, the subcommittee will now move into closed executive session portion of the meeting. Again, thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, so I'll look out for that email.
It's in my outbox, in the drafts folder. That's
okay.
Why you didn't see it.
Okay.
I just looked through my phone, as so many others are. I sat five, I drafted five,
okay.
And they're all sitting in my outbox. So I will send that
thank
to you,
you.
You'll have it in.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Right, yeah.